Hello, and welcome to Landwise, promoting sustainable crop production, a podcast series about sustainable ways to grow food in New Zealand. I'm Georgia O'Brien, Extension Coordinator for Landwise, based in Hastings. Landwise has been around since 1999, helping farmers and growers to develop and test new practices through on-farm trials and extending cutting-edge research to the farm or orchard gate. Through our podcast series, we are bringing the insights of lead researchers, technologists, and farmers to listeners from all over the ag and hort industry. Each month has a theme, with guests joining us weekly for discussions. At the end of the month, we'll have them back as a panel to talk together and respond to your queries. This month, we're looking at reducing nitrogen losses from intensive vegetable cropping, brought to you by our platinum sponsors BASF, Hawke's Bay Regional Council, Vegetables New Zealand, and Processed Vegetables New Zealand. I'm excited to be joined today by Jay Clark, Director at Woodhaven Gardens, a family-owned and operated vegetable growing business based in Horowhenua in the Manawatū. Woodhaven grows a diverse range of 23 vegetable crops, operating on more than 1,000 hectares. Their annual production comprises 10% of the national supply of leafy green fresh vegetables in New Zealand. Woodhaven Gardens has been working hard to meet and exceed environmental targets in their region. In April 2020, Woodhaven was recognised for their efforts at the Balanced Farm Environment Awards, being named the Horizons Regional Supreme Winner. So Jay, thanks for joining me today. I wanted to start by asking what the first changes you made on farm when thinking about how to improve your environmental footprint.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Georgia. Look, I guess the very first changes that we made were really a change in mindset around how we approach the relationship between being farmers or growers and also our environment and our community. It wasn't something that was really born about from trying to meet, say, regional government compliance tasks or anything like that. We really kind of had a look at how we were operating, had a look at how the community saw us and what changes the community wanted to see in our farming practice or in end results in the environment that we farm in. So,
So it was a really collaborative thing.
The big first change that we made was just completely sort of looking at how we were farming in a completely different way. And that involved going out and talking to community stakeholders like iwi, like some of the local sort of environmental groups in our community, groups like the regional council and the district council, and actually openly and honestly sort of having a dialogue around what they wanted to see in terms of the environment that we farmed in and how we farmed and what then we could do about that. So that was the first step that we looked at doing. And then from there, we sort of took that away and said, right, well, what's the low-hanging fruit? Mm. What are the things that we can change sort of quickly and easily and cheaply around the farm to start to align ourselves and our growing practice with what the community wanted to see from us?
And what were some of those low-hanging fruit that you were talking about, the easy, cheap first steps that growers can take?
Yeah, I think the first thing that you've got to do is understand your environmental impact, and that comes through data collection. The very, very first underlying step for change is knowing what you're currently doing and what is the current status quo in terms of what your environmental impacts are. When I'm talking environmental impacts, I'm almost talking in a broader sense, because it may be something that's not huge, having a huge detrimental environmental impact, something like mud on the road, but may actually have quite a big impact in your community as well, because a lot of this is about social license to farm, making sure that our communities are happy for us to operate in those communities. Not that they're just happy for us to continue operating, but actually proud of it and that they take pride in what's happening in their communities. So when they drive past your farm or your paddock that you're growing in or farming on, that they look there and that's something that they take pride of and they're glad that that is in their region and their community.
Right, so it's a really collaborative sense of being a part of the wider community around you and understanding how you're impacting them as well as the environmental.
Exactly, because I think if you go about it any other way, you run the risk, Georgia, of just becoming a tick box exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go and you say, right, well, these are some proposed compliance regulations, for example, that are going to be set by the regional council, and how would we achieve those, and your sole focus is that, then I think you run the exercise of spending a whole lot of money trying to change things to meet those sort of compliance objectives without really sort of rebuilding your business in a sustainable way, and also bringing the community alongside with you. So you might be able to go and get a resource consent on paper, but if you haven't got the community alongside, it's only a matter of time until those regulations are going to change again on you through community pressure.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So moving on from the social licence aspect of things,
yes,
and to something more technical, nitrogen fertiliser is obviously a vital component to achieving a good yield in conventional cropping systems.
Yes.
How have you been able to cut back without compromising on this yield?
Yeah, I'll probably stop you there, Georgia, and actually say that it's not nitrogen fertiliser and it's not conventional cropping systems. Really, what we should be saying is nitrogen is vital to achieving yield in any cropping system.
True.
So it doesn't matter whether you're getting your nitrogen from synthetic fertilizer, a little blue prills that's come in a bag of nitrofosca, or you're getting it from chicken manure or from growing a crop of lupin, say, before you grow your crop of lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
The element that you require is nitrogen, and it is all the same. So what we've got to understand is that we can't grow vegetable crops without nitrogen. So whether we're organic or conventional, and how we're getting that nitrogen is not really shouldn't really be the focus.
Okay.
So in saying that, what we sort of did is take the principle that you don't want to have any more nitrogen in your system than is sort of required to get optimal yield. So it's that sort of nitrogen, understanding that nitrogen yield curve. So the more nitrogen you put into the system, the higher the yield will go up to a certain point, and then it doesn't matter how much more nitrogen you tip into the system, your yield will plateau, and in fact, in leafy greens like we grow, it'll actually start to decrease because you'll start to get too soft a growth and you won't grow your product to the market specifications that are required to actually sell the product.
Yeah, so it's a delicate
balance.
So we're
self-regulating in a way when leafy green vegetables in terms of nitrogen use.
Yeah.
From there, the next steps for us was understanding that sort of nitrogen loss versus yield ratio. So it was to go and to monitor the nitrogen in the soil. So we worked with you guys at Landwise to put the quicking test is practice right across our whole farming system. So we go and we test in high-risk areas, so high-risk catchment. We're testing the nitrate in the soil profile throughout the root zone before planting or sowing, before any side dressing applications or secondary applications, and then after we've harvested the crop, so that we're monitoring the nitrate in the soil the whole way through.
Right.
And that we have the right appropriate levels of nitrate in the soil for each different crop and for each different time of year. Now, that's a real delicate balancing act, and it's not a 1 + 1 = 2 type equation. It's more a 1 + x = 2 type equation, and we'll never quite know what x is. And that's where your skill as a vegetable, grower has to come into play, because you're always going to be guessing exactly how much nitrate you need to put on to a certain extent, because you won't know what's coming down the track in terms of climatic changes or changes within the soil microbiology, for example, that will change the amount of nitrogen available to the crop after you've applied your last lot of fertiliser up until your point of harvest. So there is still a bit of a guessing game there, but by monitoring it with the equipment, it's just an extra piece of information that informs you that aids you to make better decisions.
Yeah.
And we've found that to be a really, really valuable tool to other one was that the other way that we sort of approached it was looking at our farming system and identifying low yield areas.
So,
the example to give with our farm is we do controlled traffic farming. So we have tramways that we drive agricultural vehicles up and down so that we can apply fertiliser or ag chem or run irrigators up and down, etc. Now, those years where we were driving up and down, the yield was always a lot lower, and that was due to things like compaction, mud splash, damage from the vehicles turning in and out of the bed, etc. So, but at the same time, we were putting the same amount of fertiliser on those beds as we were everywhere else, but just getting a far lower yield.
Oh, okay.
So if you do your basic mass balance, you'll say, right, well, we're going to be losing significantly more nitrogen in those areas. So we made the decision that we would no longer crop those beds. And in fact, we made the decision that we'd no longer crop half of the beds on either side of that tramway as well. So we took 2 out of 13 beds, or roughly 18% of our croppable land, out of production completely. Now, that was a big decision and an expensive one. But when we were looking at it, if we were putting the same amount of fertiliser on but only getting 30 or 40% of yield out of those beds compared to getting 80% yield on all the rest, it made sense that that was the area that we attacked in terms of trying to improve our nitrogen losses.
Okay, so separating that roadway from the garden and recognising those different uses for those areas.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that was the whole idea of it. So it was to say we want to go after nitrogen loss in terms of trying to reduce it. So where is the area on our farm that is best to attack it? Now, everybody's farm may be different and everybody's farming systems will be different, but the principle will remain the same. So maybe somebody has a block that has a bit of a gully in it that they don't get great crops out of because they've got a low area and it gets really wet there, and you know, should you continue to farm that? And if you were trying to improve nitrogen losses, perhaps you just take the view that, no, well, that area on the farm we're not going to plant, and we'll take that out, and you know, we'll prioritise the best areas and the best land on our farm as a place to do our cropping. So it will be highly varied for what crops you're growing, where you're growing, how you're growing them, but the principle is saying, right, where is our lowest yielding, poorest performing parts of the farm? Those are the parts of the farm that we should probably look at maybe addressing in order to protect our most highly productive use of fertilizer on our most highly productive areas.
Yeah, so that definitely makes sense by splitting up your paddock into the best areas and the worst, and treating them differently.
Exactly. And for some people, that may mean that they take a block and they only crop that block, particularly in the summer, because it gets, say, too wet in the winter and the yields are too low, and they're having to put a whole ton of fert on to try and keep that block being productive. So it may be a timing, like when you're farming it,
right?
What crops you put on, or how you're setting a particular block up. And it is really, this is where farm environment plans become so important, because each farm and each farming system will be extremely different. So I don't think it's so much about finding or here's a prescribed recipe on how to do it. It's about talking about the principles of identifying like low yielding areas and saying, right, well, is it appropriate to keep farming those?
Yes, definitely. So moving on from that, what tools and recording systems have you found useful to not only assess your progress, but record all of your varied and multiple inputs?
We started on this journey a long, long time ago. So although we just recently won the Horizons Region Balanced Farmer Environment Award, the Supreme Award, we entered in quite a few years ago based on a software system that we had developed ourselves called Hortrack, which we had in the first instance developed so that we could keep track of costs, but we soon found out it actually enabled us to capture all our input data so that we could track our environmental progress as well. So we, at that time, couldn't find anything on the market that was really appropriate for fresh veggies.
Mm-hmm.
There were some programs out there that were sort of applicable to big broadacre operations that you were doing monocropping over large areas, and they kind of they worked for that, but they weren't sort of really nimble enough for what you call a traditional multi-crop market garden type setup. So we went out and built our own. And so in that system, we record every single input and process that happens to a crop. So we go in and assign a crop a paddock location, obviously the area that is going to be in crop and the total area that has to we have to take out of our farm to facilitate that crop, and they are sort of two different things. Like I explained, we have those tramways that are blank.
Right,
yeah. So you have a bit of land that's actually fallow within your cropping system there as well. We take out the time that's spent on cultivating the land, planting the crop, how many exact number of plants that go into that cropping area, any of the inputs that go on that crop in terms of fertiliser, ag chem, irrigation, and then time spent harvesting, the amount of units that we harvest on each crop, so therefore we can account for the amount of residual that's left behind as well, and then we start the whole process again for the next crop the next time round. So we're doing that for every single crop and every single planting or sowing. We assign a crop number and all those things are recorded. So not only gives us the ability to monitor whether each individual crop was profitable or not, it allows us to have a look at the inputs and work out our nitrogen losses based on what our inputs were versus what yield we took off.
Yeah, right. So you've got a lot of data that you can work through and refer to later when you're trying to figure out what might have gone wrong with a crop or what potential improvements you could make.
Exactly. And I think a lot of farmers just look at this as a compliance burden. So they go, right, well, that's going to take me a hell of a lot of time to record all that data and put it into some sort of a software system to work out what my nitrogen losses may or may not be. And they're 100% right, it does. What you need to do is say, right, what are the uses then I have for that data within my business that are actually going to help me to be a better farmer? And that's why, say, for example, we're attaching the monetary value to those inputs so that you're recording your costs and you can work out a true crop-by-crop profit and loss and say, well, look, is iceberg lettuce in the spring profitable or not? Is growing radish in August profitable or not? It enables you to actually make good fundamental business decisions as well. So you can get some value back out of recording that data. It doesn't have to come a cost to your business.
Yeah, that's really clever. So thinking about some more on-farm technologies, can you describe or talk about some of those advancements that Woodhaven has been adopting to improve environmental outcomes?
Yeah, so we talked about the quick end test previously, sort of briefly, and that's been a fantastic one in terms of being able to monitor soil nitrate. It's quick, it's easy to use, it gives pretty reliable results once you've got a consistent in your approach at using it. And it needs a bit of ground truthing. You know, we still regularly send results away to Hill's laboratory to actually monitor what their nitrate result is versus what we're getting on the quick end test to ground truth everything. But that's been a real fantastic one for us in terms of being able to improve our environmental outcome overall. The other one that's really, really big is in terms of technology is GPS and controlled traffic farming.
So right.
We know that when we compact soil, we change the soil microbiology and we start to leach more for a multitude of reasons. You get lower crop yield, which increases nitrogen losses. You change your soil microbiology, which increases nitrogen losses as well. And you change also how your soils drain, which can also increase nitrogen losses. So of being able to avoid compaction by having your GPS and making sure you're driving your equipment in the same place so that your growing surface neither gets sort of equipment over the top and neither gets compacted is a huge way of improving our environmental outcomes. Now, unfortunately, that's not the sort of thing that you can go and then chuck into an overseer model and take to a regional council and say, look, I'm great, I've dropped my nitrogen leaching by X number of units per hectare. But we know that it is one of the fundamentals in terms of reducing nitrogen in mosses and improving your outcomes is avoiding compaction. So GPS technology is fantastic. Now, I think any farmer or any grower that started playing with GPS, I think they've almost instantly fallen in love with it and tended to adopt it right across their whole farming system. But for people out there that maybe haven't had a play with it and been able to see the benefits of it, it is, I know they're big capital outlays, but it is definitely worth the money to adopt throughout your farming system.
Mm. And apart from all of the soil benefits that you were talking about, also just improving the precision of your inputs, like fertiliser and...
100%. So it allows you, say, for your fertiliser input to alongside waste cell technology on your spreaders, it means you put the fertiliser exactly where you want it and the exact amount that you want to go on, so there isn't that guessing game that you get. So whereas when you don't have GPS and you're using, say, gravity feed cyclones, you're not entirely sure how much you're putting on per hectare until you stop and you count how many bags of fertiliser's gone in a hopper versus how many hectares you've got over your back calculator.
Yep.
So there is some great technology out there in terms of precision ag allowing you to apply your input extremely accurately. Another one that we went and had a look at was having to play with putting fertiliser in the root zone when we were transplanting. So what I mean by that is instead of transplanting the crop and then side dressing alongside that crop on the surface, with then all the fertiliser sitting there sort of waiting for a rain event to wash it off down into the wheel marks and into a drain, we started injecting plugs of fertiliser alongside the transplanting so that fert was incorporated into the soil profile, and then that de-risked those sort of loss events from from taking the fertiliser off the surface of the pit.
Right.
So that was another one where sort of new technology and adding that to our transplanters has helped the environmental outcomes a lot.
Mm-hmm. So you've talked about the mindset and needing to approach environmental compliance, but improvement really from a community perspective. What other advice would you give to growers assessing their environmental compliance and looking to make improvements?
You talk to other growers. So the growers are pretty usually free and liberal with what they're doing and happy to share. There's a lot of different approaches out there, and that reflects the multitudes of different farming systems and different farming locations that there are sort of not just around New Zealand but around the world. Google is a fantastic thing. So there's a lot of times you might realise that you have an issue or have a problem and not quite worked out how to solve it yourself. And you'll be amazed at what sitting in front of your laptop for half an hour, typing things into Google will come up with in terms of providing a little bit of enlightenment about potential solutions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really encourage people to have a look more broadly than what's just happening in New Zealand, but go and have a look around the world. You know, part of our journey towards this has been having a look in Australia, having a look at what we've been down there. The UK and Europe and the States as well, and then cherry picking from those solutions with what would work with the way that we farmed and where we farmed.
Yeah, definitely. So
getting out there and having a really, really good look around is an important one as well. And then also lean on the institutions that are around New Zealand that are there to support farmers, whether it's the likes of Lincoln or Massey University, the likes of you guys at Landwise, or even just talking to people at UNV or MPI and getting on the phone and having a chat to government as well around, look, saying, you know, these are the problems that I maybe have, or I'm not sure how we're going to address this in our farming system, and they may have talked to somebody else or that has that world of information out there, and nobody is going to be able to give you the exact right recipe for your farming circumstances, but they can say, look, these are the solutions, the food solutions that other people are trying, and you can work out what you think would work best for your farm.
Yeah, that's great advice. So Woodhaven's obviously come a really long way since you first started thinking about making an impact on your environmental outcomes. What's next for Woodhaven and its environmental strategy? What potential is there for continued improvement?
Yeah, I think that comes back to, again, that dialogue that I'll harp on about it, that dialogue with the community.
Right.
So I don't think that this is something you can come along and be a flash in the pan and say to people, right, we're going to attack this year, and whatever we achieve in the next 12 or 24 months, that's it, and then we're going to walk away from it, and that's the sort of end of our environmental or sustainability journey. You know, sustainability, in its very definition, talks about the need to stay profitable, for having economic sustainability, having that social or cultural sustainability, and having environmental sustainability. So it's a journey that goes on forever. And once you sort of tackle those low-hanging fruit, it gives you a little bit more free time and space to start sort of looking at some of the bigger challenges that may be around. So for me, the journey for Woodhaven Gardens is one where we keep working alongside iwi, we keep working alongside other community groups to say, right, well, you know, here we are, we've tidied up these low-hanging fruit. We know that there's maybe some bigger issues that Woodhaven Gardens can't tackle on their own, but how can we play a role in facilitating solutions to those bigger issues? You know, whether it's an advocacy role, whether that's through working with council in terms of helping to provide funding for bigger projects that are beyond Woodhaven just happening by itself. Whatever those pieces are, you know, how can we contribute to sort of some of those bigger solutions to bigger problems? So I think that's us. So we'll keep working along our partners in the science and advisory world as well, to bring hopefully contributions to those solutions going forward.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing Woodhaven's story with us, Jay, and as always, contributing to this discussion around sustainable vegetable production. We wish you all the best for continuing your good work.
Thank you very much, George. It's been a pleasure. We'll be right back.